Semitic ways of the 80s and 90s, the decline of political anti-Semitism by 1900, and the shifting of its focus from quote politics to culture. What we must come to now is the reaction of both the Jewish community as a community, or communities as communities, as well as the reaction of individuals to this kind of anti-Semitic way which we have been talking about in the last lecture. The reactions were obviously both of a personal and of a community nature. It is the community reaction with which I want to start, for they are simpler to analyze and more straightforward. In fact, we can sum up the community reaction in this way, that the wave of anti-Semitism, Turkey, Louisa, the Dreyfus affair, for the first time forced and admitted, a very reluctant admittance, that there may have to be specific Jewish interests to be defended. Now, why was there such a reluctant admission? Because it went against the grain of the ideal of emancipation and the ideal of citizenship, that there were in a nation specific Jewish interests. It seemed somewhat to give in to the accusation which I lectured about before, that the Jews were a state within a state. And therefore, that reluctant admission, after all, was a matter against emancipation and common and equal citizenship ideas. As a result, the Jewish communities merely formed themselves as national communities for the first time at the end of the century. In Germany, in 1893, the Central Association of Germans of the Jewish Faith, knows the title of the German National Jewish Organization, Germans of the Jewish Faith. And already before, in 1890, the German Anti-Defamation League has been founded. These organizations were obviously organizations of notables. That is to say, organizations of the wealthier, more important leaders of the community who were elected to them, who controlled them and managed them. The problem that they faced was immediately a problem of politicization, for such a national organization, reluctantly formed for the defense of specific Jewish interests, enter politics at all. The theory was always against politicization. The reality was quite different. From the beginning, the German organization spent money to elect candidates to the Diet favorable to the Jews, spent money for propaganda, but always they were held back by what one contemporary called the fear of ghettoization. Indeed, the whole reaction of the official community is dominated by this fear of ghettoization. For example, the German Jews refused to call a congress of all Jewish organizations to discuss common concerns. Such a congress, they thought, was too public, might have too unfavorable a kind of reaction. Only in the 1920s did the Central Organization of Jews, of Germans, of Jewish faith, only then did they go into propaganda. Then in the 1920s, they sophisticated way. Or then did they open an office in Berlin, which went under the flag of Turkish nationalists, and many of the articles in Turkish, even Nazi papers, were planted by the central organization of German Jews, as we now know, in order to divide the right, in order to sow confusion. But only in the 20s did they begin this quite sophisticated effort to sow chaos among the enemies of the Jews by infiltration under a false office, false name, and all of that sort. But that lies ahead. The defense which we have now is on a different level. Some traveling speakers, like in Merkel, Escher, but above all monitoring through the paper of the Anti-Defense League. And that is why the monthly of the German Defense League is one of the most valuable source materials for the anti-Semitic movements in Europe, because they didn't defend so much as monitor all anti-Semitic movements all over Europe. Their attitudes were summarized in a proclamation of 1893. That is the time when the Stöcker movement was still going, when Luiger was getting going in a big way, when the Dreyfus affair was before the door. They proclaimed as follows: "We are not starting any separation today. We are not placing our particular interests in the foreground. For us, the welfare of the fatherland, the advancement of its culture, and the prosperous development of its spiritual and economic life stand today and always in the first place. Thus it was since emancipation. Thus it will remain, as you will see, with the adjustment of specific organizations and with the pull to defend now specific Jewish interests." Matters in France were very similar indeed. The reaction to the Dreyfus affair by the Jewish community was a reaction of distress, so as not to provoke. Indeed, the recent historian of the Jewish reaction to the Dreyfus affair, Michael Morris, in his book called The Politics of Assimilation, in English, read it, The Politics of Assimilation by Michael Morris, comes to the conclusion that the French Jewish community almost ignored the Dreyfus affair. But here there was a reason, and a stronger reason than in Germany. Reliance upon the Gentiles to fight the battle. Now why? There are some things you must take into consideration. In France, during the Dreyfus affair, there were only 86,000 Jews among 39 million people. There were only a few more Jews than in the state of Wisconsin among 39 million people. In Germany, the balance was a little better, but not much better. Some 200,000 Jews among 40 million people. But in France, there was an additional factor, which I mentioned before. Was France not the country of the revolution? Was France not the first country which had emancipated the Jews? Was France not the country of the Enlightenment? The Jewish community relied upon the moral strength of the French nation. They took refuge, if you like, in an optimism that no matter what happens now, the spirit of 1789 would indeed reassert itself. The famous sociologist Emil Durkheim, who was an Alsatian Jew, put it this way in 1898: "Our anti-Semitism in France is the consequence of a superficial symptom of a social illness. By contrast, to the anti-Semitism found in Germany or Russia, which is chronic and traditional. Yet, of course, the optimism here was scarcely warranted. The anti-Semitic workers' movement, which I mentioned last time, did exist. Out of it came an anti-Semitic political party, the Action Française, or the French Action. A literary anti-Semitism did exist indeed, and we shall come back to it. What failed in France, as everywhere, was political anti-Semitism. But it is greatly to be doubted whether for all this failure, and for the failure of mass movements in France, which I have stressed, a failure that made Dreyfus episodic, anti-Semitism in France was not, as a matter of fact, just as strong as in Germany. Those of you, and that it came to fore in every crisis, those of you are too young, who were in France during Algeria, will know that. For the graffiti, you know what graffiti are, the scribblings in the laboratory. Graffiti were full of anti-Semitism. Indeed, I spent a great deal of the year of 1816 going around with Madame Imbert, who is the director of the little Jewish library in Paris, with a hammer and a chisel, taking these graffiti from the walls, three ladies I met, in the Paris subway. And therefore, there now exists a very significant collection, the first one, I think, of anti-Semitic graffiti in Paris. Which I don't think Mr. Weinberg has examined. No. Which is, of course, extremely important for popular anti-Semitism, an extremely important matter. But why close these graffiti? And these graffiti have all the stereotypes. The conspiracy, the stereotype, everything that we have talked about is in these graffiti, especially in the subway station of Châtelet, where everybody changes lots of time for these matters. The question is that what you have there in these graffiti is, of course, a sign that for all the failure of political anti-Semitism, French anti-Semitism was far from their superficial. And that indeed it broke out among the people, for this is popular literature, which I'm talking to you about, among the people became extremely deep. Remember something, you're dealing not with Americans, but with the literate people. The graffiti here in the University of Wisconsin are not worth the chiseling off. But these graffiti in France were often 5 or 7 sentences. In other words, people who had no outlet for literary endeavor took this, and it is therefore extremely important evidence. As a matter of fact, you have such optimism also in Germany. For let us remember that the notables who controlled the official Jewish organization were liberals, after all. And though in Germany there was no tradition of 1789, this optimism was shared. For example, a French newspaper notes with satisfaction that of the 34 members of the executive committee of the League for the Rights of Men, which was a pro-Dreyfus League, only 3 were Jews. To make it short, the Dreyfus affair was not in France a turning point in the history of the Jews, but instead one more episode in the steady march towards emancipation. The same thing can be said for the official Jewish communities in Central Europe. The anti-Semitic wave was not a turning point, but part of the steady march towards emancipation instead. Why? Remember, the communities turned out to be correct. Remember that by 1900 political anti-Semitism was dead. Remember, Dreyfus won the Dreyfus affair. Remember, remember that after 1900, anti-Semitism became cultural and not political. So that the notables could say quite rightly, our attitude was the right one. We did not panic. We gave up as little of our drive to emancipation as possible. And look, we have won. It did work. The tactics seem to be justified. Now this again is very important. For this leadership of notables trained a new one in its image. And it is the leadership of notables that these people of the 80s and 90s trained, which was to face National Socialism in Europe. And now you can understand how these notables, when they face National Socialism, thought, is this not merely another Dreyfus affair? Is this not merely another anti-Semitic wave, as we had in the 1880s and 90s? Is Hitler not merely another Christian socialist? Therefore, the same tactics of discretion might work now, might work in the 1920s, as they worked in the 80s and 90s. This you must remember. When the notable state people like Eichmann, you must remember that the tactics of dealing with the first anti-Semitic wave were successful, so why not apply it here? You must remember that the notables were and remain liberal, that they were and remain optimists, that they were and remain wedded to the idea of emancipation. That you must not forget. For how did they refuse the charges of anti-Semitism? What was their policy of defense in the 80s and 90s when it first arose? What was their policy of defense? The official policy of defense was this. It continued the ideal of emancipation, of what a Jew be. And because it continued the idea of emancipation, it meant admitting by indirect the existence of the Jewish stereotype. It meant, in fact, letting the enemy define the terrain from which you fight. Because emancipation and assimilation share the terrain with the enemy. They too were opposed to the stereotype, to financial practices, and all of that sort of thing. They shared terrain with the enemy. Kippiger was the defense of the Viennese community in 1882. That is when the first movement got going. The Viennese community met and decided to do three things of defense. First, to issue a popular book explaining Jewish ethics. The reason for that is, as I have told you before, that anti-Semitism above all attacks the lack of ethics among Jews, because Judaism was not a religion because of financial practice. Therefore, the reply was a book explaining Jewish ethics. After all, remember this, Stoecker had said in the Prussian Diet, the Jewish question is a question of ethics. And so you have to reply by issuing a book on ethics. Secondly, to fight the presumably usurious rate of interest charged by the Jews. Interestingly enough, the Jewish community assumed that. They never made a study of how much interest Jewish merchants actually charge. But it's fairly typical that they assumed that Jews made usurious rates of interest, that this was true, and therefore it had to be false. And thirdly, to wean Jewish youth from commerce and guide them to agriculture and into the artisan trade. Everywhere, we'll have to come back to that. learnedly or unlearnedly, but you all know who Dome is. So repeat Dome once again. That was the answer. Repeat once again the ideals of emancipation. But if you did this, you were fighting from the terrain of the enemy. But the ideal of emancipation meant fighting the Jewish stereotypes by Jews as well as anti-Semites. This was the thing, together with something else that comes from liberalism and emancipation, together with an emphasis on famous Jews who accomplished something in the arts and sciences, but above all in war and patriotism. Famous Jewish warriors. Well, there ain't that many, but the Maccabees come in now. Famous Jewish warriors. Famous Jewish patriots. Not sure, dragged by the hair. I agree. Sometimes I'm not so quite sure whether these people were Jews at all. But that doesn't matter here. There. The question is this. The defense here is what? It is trying to argue rationally with irrational moves. That's what it is. The anti-Semites say Jews are evil, but there is the great patriot. The anti-Semites say Jews are all bankers and commercial people, but here is the great Jewish warrior. This kind of defense is based on liberalism and rationalism. But tragedy was that it had to argue with irrationalism and anti-liberalism. The problematic here is very easy to see. Two things that we must say about the official defense. First of all, it defines itself on the terrain of the enemy. And secondly, it counters irrationalism with rational arguments. Irrationalism with rational arguments. The Jewish notables, these wealthy Jews who controlled the communities, were liberals, were the creatures of the development of emancipation and assimilation, successful in society. So that they again termed this symbiosis of Jew and liberalism. If you think Jewish defense has changed today, you're totally mistaken. Everything that I have said about the 1880s and 90s, I would say about present Jewish defense activity. So that what you have is actually a kind of tragedy, and you must regard it that way, I think. Here too, the liberal heritage came home to roost. Not only did the Jews in those days lose their political base through the erosion of liberalism, but they kept a liberal attitude which was less and less effective as against anti-Semitic movements which were obviously illiberal. Only a tiny Zionist majority called in 1900 for a liquidation of liberalism among Jews. But those who called for liquidation of liberalism among Jews were a tiny Zionist minority. I think that now you can realize another trend in Jewish history. Now you can see, in a sense, what the trend we started with Moses Mendelssohn, assimilation and emancipation, what difficulty it came into already in the first anti-Semitic wave and from then on in. For we must remember, the world of notables is the world of most Jews. And here now again I want to resort to an example, a very famous example, the example of Sigmund Freud. For he is an excellent example of the clinging to this kind of ideal of rationalism, liberalism, and emancipation and citizenship in this regard. An
about whom you will hear more later, Victor Adler. Victor Adler and Troy both, in their youth, when they were about your age, joined a nationalistic German student fraternity. And the importance of that, so did Theodor Herzl. Herzl, Troy, Victor Adler, believe it or not, were all in the same nationalistic German student fraternity in the 70s. They were all in that same fraternity, quite a fraternity. But the problem was, of course, that a Jew could not stay there, after all, in what is called the Labour Verein of 1873, that is this fraternity of 1873. They were swept away by this nationalism, by the Neuweger movement. So the question was, what should they fasten on to? We now come to this question, and we shall remain there for a while. With what community could they link? Freud, Adler, Herzl, all tried to link with the most exciting community of the time, which undoubtedly was the nationalist community and the nationalist fraternity. Undoubtedly. But for a Jew, that was no longer possible. And it is then that Freud begins to cling to rationalism, to emancipation, to all of these ideas. It is then that he becomes a liberal. A liberal. And then it is then that he becomes to define the liberal society, which becomes his society. But it is typical that as late as 1930, it is typical for these middle-class Jews, that as late as 1930, liberalism was finished. Liberal parties had maybe one member in parliament, in Germany two. Liberalism was finished. That when it was finished, he wrote, in civilization and its discontent, another confession of faith to a liberal society. The end result, he said, of sublimation and transference. The end result would be a state of law to which all have contributed by making some sacrifice of their own desire, and which leaves none at the mercy of brute force. A society of law, a liberal society. Just as in civilization and its discontent, a few pages onward, he condemns communism and says that private property is indeed the natural consequence of human aggression and not aggression of private property, and that private property is indeed necessary as a focus of aggression, as a mitigation of aggression. Law and private property. And one can go further. In 1930 again, Freud exalts cleanliness and order as a mark of society. So that somebody like Freud, coming out of the middle-class Viennese community, the early fusion with nationalism didn't work. Somebody like Freud, now for the rest of his life, like so many middle-class Jews, clings to this kind of liberalism, this kind of liberal commitment. And here we must quote a famous letter of 1926, a letter he wrote to the Jewish organization Bnei Brit, where he said the following, and it is an interesting and significant letter about the subject at hand. I share with my fellow Jews the secret of a similar construction of my soul. Most romantic thing to say. I owe to my Jewish the two qualities which have become indispensable in my difficult life. Because I was a Jew, I was free from many of the prejudices of other people, from many of the limitations of the Gentile's intellect. As a Jew, I was prepared to live in opposition and to deny myself the union with any compact majority. Now, what is interesting about this letter, I think it's clear, is the utter confusion of Jew and liberal. For Freud, liberal and Jew have become the same thing, have become utterly the same thing. For what he says is nothing particularly Jewish. Many Jews did not go into opposition. None of the Jewish notables, none of the Jewish communities certainly did. Very few Jews were willing to deny themselves union with the majority. Otherwise, we would not have had so many Jews who became socialists or Jews who attempted still to become nationalists. In other words, when Freud said that it is nothing especially Jewish to be in opposition, when he said it is something Jewish to be without the prejudice of the Gentiles, what he means is really to be a liberal, not to be a Jew, because this is not normative for Jewish life, but it is normative for the liberal ideal. And the importance of this letter of 1926 is, after all, how close, by that time even, in the mind of a man like Freud, liberalism and Jew were the same. And of course, at the precise time, dialectically, when liberalism in Gentile society and in Gentile politics was no longer an important factor, was indeed a very minor factor by 1926. What about those Jewish intellectuals who were not as optimistic as Freud, not as committed a liberal as Freud and Herzl? I will tell you now a little secret, which I didn't want to let out until we come to Herzl, but which I'll go through with you. The Jewish state, the famous Herzl Jewish state, what is the Jewish state? It's a liberal utopia. It's the last liberal utopia. That's what Herzl's Jewish state actually is. The last liberal utopia. It's kind of funny. And irrelevant. And we are comfort. But Freud, Herzl, all these people, rebounding from rejection into liberalism. But there were some who did not. For those Jews who did not, who could not go to liberalism, for many of them, there came to be a deep pessimism. This was especially true with Freud's great friend, the writer Arthur Schnitzler. What would you know of Schnitzler? You would know of Schnitzler's the movie La Ronde, right? You don't know La Ronde anymore, the movie. No? Well, I'm sorry, these things are all a little out of date. I mean, Schnitzler had nothing to do with trash. Naked bodies were not his thing. I'm sorry if you don't know anything about Schnitzler, I can't help you. However, he was famous, take my word for it. Somebody like Arthur Schnitzler then was extremely pessimistic. In a play called The Path to Freedom, Schnitzler of 1894, Schnitzler shows the dilemma of the younger generation of cultivated DNA students. The Path to Freedom shows that dilemma in a dissolving liberal universe. For each young Jew in that play is forced to take a path in life that distorts his real nature. For the options to it have become so small. For example, the young Jew who wants to go into politics is forced to become a frustrated writer. For politics is closed. Jewish. It's false to become a militant socialist. That needs some explanation, because for you, attractive young Jewish and militant socialists are opposite. But you are now in the 1890s, and they are opposite. The attractive young Jewish, whose destiny it was to preside over a salon, to look beautiful and decorative. Social circles were close to her, so she distorts the nature by becoming a militant socialist. Something in the 1890s, of course, unfeminine and totally to be rejected for beautiful girls. The young and Schnitzler wrote it, I didn't. So, by God, I have some sympathy. Now, the young Jew, you know, I shouldn't say that, but all these idiocies around the University of Wisconsin, about 5 years ago, one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen, and boy, what revolution came out of her mouth. And there was some kind of a thing for my generation of having this beautiful girl calling for death and hanging. My death! My death!
Discern three paths which young Jews were likely to take.
you might have the same problem. What then were the alternatives? Two of them were attempts to transcend Jewishness. This is an obvious reaction, an immediate reaction. One, into nationalism. To do it successfully, what Herzl and Freud, Victor Adler, had not done successfully in their student days. The second is to transcend Judaism once more, but this time to socialism. And the third is science. It is the least important. It's just true. Now look, I'm coming to Zionism. Let's get this into perspective. Until 1933, Zionism was of no importance. It was even of minor importance in Eastern Europe. It only became important with Hitler. So that what you have there was an important movement among Jews. It was not before, even in Eastern Europe. So what you have are two major alternatives, the national and the social, and one minor alternative, the Zionist alternative. One minor alternative, two major ones. Notice what was not an alternative, liberalism. Why? For these young Jews were also engaged in a revolt against their elders. They were a part of the total revolt of youth in the 1880s and 90s, which some of you have studied perhaps from a different direction. But the total revolt of youth in the 1880s and 90s. These young Jews, let us be clear about that, deplored their fathers as much as everybody deplored their fathers of the middle classes. The working classes don't have time to deplore their fathers. The middle classes deplore their fathers in the 1880s and 1890s. And from that point of view, what difference did it make whether the father with his thick cigar, his title, and his wealth went to a meeting of the Jewish community or to the National Diet? It's no difference from the point of view of youth. And what difference does it make whether the mother went to the Jewish auxiliary, a doctor did not yet exist, to the Jewish community auxiliary, and a Christian equivalent went to the Dorcas Society, this is the Christian equivalent. From the point of view, it makes no difference. So what you must remember now, when we came to the young Jews who took these alternatives, you must remember two things. You must remember what was lost. First of all, they rejected liberalism. As all youth in the 1890s, all middle class youth, I'm sorry, in the 1880s and 90s, rejected liberalism. And secondly, the young Jewish youth also revolted against their elders, as everyone did. In the age of expressionism, in the age of Vedicism, all these plays and ideas that you may have studied elsewhere. But their option were limited. The main option was to try to transcend their Jewishness. But, and here is another important point, even the Zionists tried to do that. That is to say, all these alternatives, having common and transcendence, socialism and nationalism in more complete transcendence, Zionism a transcendence of the Jewish stereotype. For oddly enough, it will be the Zionists who agree with the Jewish notables that Jews should be retrained and go to the soil and try to escape from the stereotype. All of these, like the notables, and this they had in common with, fought from the terrain which the enemy had to find. All these young Jews rejected the ghetto, which they believed was real traditional Jewishness. All of them rejected the Jewish religion, For they also believed now that it was fossilized and merely a commercial transaction. All of them rejected the Jewish stereotype and tried to flee from it, to pray from it, back to the soil, into all humanity, or into the nation, but to flee in some way from the stereotype itself. That is also a background which you had better from now on keep in mind. Now remember, no lecture on Friday, and on Monday I shall go ahead with the stereotype.